Welcome to the Law Shit You Should Know podcast. We're here to talk a little bit about the law
and a whole lot about nothing. Every week, we have a new guest to discuss current events, legal drama, and dive even deeper into
the Law Shit You Should Know.
All right. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to Law Shit You Should Know with Alina Santana
and Leslie Marenko.
And today we have the amazing Jonathan Goldstein. Hi, Jonathan.
Hi.
So tell everybody watching who you are, what you do, why you're here with us today.
Okay, so I'm Jonathan Goldstein. I'm a partner with Haber Law PA, and I'm board certified in condominium and plan development law. I co-chair our firm's community association practice group. And essentially, I like to say that I represent condominium associations, homeowners associations, and the unit owners who love them.
Oh, you'll do both sides?
The unit owners?
You'll represent like a unit owner
sometimes,
also?
Sometimes.
We're, as long as you're not conflicted out?
Yeah, as long as we're not conflicted out and there's a little bit of a presumption against it that can be overcome.
Okay, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
But good I know. Like the, and the unit owners that love them.
That love them.
Because they do, right? They love their...
Love and hate. The thin line between love and hate.
So I've never lived in a place, I've never bought a place that had a condo. And
lucky you.
Yeah, apparently from what I'm hearing. And so how do people get on these boards? How do you choose? Alina, you were on a board. How did you decide that this was going to be a good use of your time, Alina?
True story. So I was president of my homeowners association for quite a while. For about almost 4 years, I think, or just over four.
Oh my
years.
God.
Yeah, I know. Way too long. But no, my story was a little unique. I did not run for my board.
Oh, people usually run for this?
Yes, there's an election. Yeah.
It's like,
it's an election. It's everybody wants to be on these crazy ass boards. I did not run. When I was a brand new owner, I had been very frustrated by my buying experience because the association at the time wasn't being responsive to the documents we needed to close. And so when I did close and finally became a homeowner, I actually went to the first board meeting that happened. To bitch and moan.
Did you tell them what a terrible job they were doing?
Correct. I was really upset. And I was like, you know, you're preventing people from being able to buy, sell. And like, it's part of like the betterment of the community. You can't like make it difficult to buy. Like, this is good for us, right? So anyways, I went to bitch and moan basically at the first meeting where I was promptly told that our board of three only had a board of two and asked if I wanted to volunteer for the third.
Since you're bitching, please come join us.
If you want something done right, you got to do it yourself.
Uh-huh. Change, right?
Yeah. The change Peter's you want to see.
You want to see in the world.
Aww.
And so I volunteered.
And she said, sure.
There. I wanted good things for my brand new property.
Most rational people would be like, no, thank you. I got to go.
Actually,
running a law firm, you know?
It's worth emphasizing in terms of like loving condos. Like, it takes a certain kind of passion and involvement to be a volunteer director.
I know.
It's not paid.
No.
You know, in 99% of the cases, there's rare cases it could be, but theoretically. But it's not paid. You're spending a ton of time under tremendous scrutiny, dealing with all kinds of drama.
It's a labor of love.
Yeah.
It's a labor of love. No, but I honestly, I've dealt with HOAs my whole life. Our original community where I grew up, not grew up, but like joined when I was like a teenager. My parents still, it wasn't a condo, but it was an HOA, similar concept, you know, a closed gated community that they dealt with all the public space. And I absolutely see the value in them because I am not the type of person who wants to deal with mowing grass. Like, I just don't give a fuck. I'm a city dweller. I love the idea of a condo. I love someone else handling the pool maintenance. You know, I really love this concept. And for me, where we were in this board that I was a part of was like a townhouse community. So it was kind of the best of both worlds. I didn't have to deal with high rise and some of the things that go along with that. But I also didn't have to mow my own grass, which was kind of nice.
Sure.
And there's usually a pool sometimes.
Yeah, and two pools. My community had two pools and a tennis court, actually, and like a racquetball court. Anyways. So I said, sure, I'll volunteer for this third empty seat. And so I was appointed to the third seat. And then just 2 or 3 months later, the other two board members quit. And I became president.
I was going to say, it didn't dawn on her that there's a reason why this seat is empty.
Yep, we got you. We're out of here.
Like, it just like occurred to her. Like, why is there nobody else on this board?
And then he quit and I became
the only person.
Yeah, and so I had to start recruiting other people to be on the board. Eventually, I did recruit two others with me, and then nobody ran for years because every year we'd have an election and no one would run. And so we'd continue to be in charge. And for 4 years, I was president of my homeowners association, never having run for this position in my life.
And actually, you know, when it, nowadays, the law has changed so that new directors within 90 days have to take like a certification course, or they have to read the entire book of governing documents, and they sign a form that they swear they've read the governing documents and will uphold them, and they have to.
The liability that attaches to this role, Jonathan. Tell me how crazy this is.
Actually, there's like a whole business judgment rule. And directors have a very high threshold before they can be sued personally.
God.
So like if you're a director, you generally can't be sued unless your actions are like willful or reckless.
Okay.
Or criminal or self-dealing, where you get like an improper personal benefit.
Sure.
But like, yeah, the key thing is like this reckless standard. Yeah. Because recklessness, what does that mean? It's more than just negligence. There's like a statutory standard of care, like listen to professionals, listen to reliable sources of information, you know, do things in a reasonable way.
Yeah.
Do that, you're more likely to be found you're not reckless. If you ignore it, fly in the face of it, and you're just kind of like, who cares? That may be reckless. And I think that reckless standard, maybe it shifts a little bit after Champlain Tower South and that tragedy, perhaps. So how that standard is judged could be changing.
Yeah.
But people go to these courses and they love it. Like we give this huge course, covers all this information, and everybody wants to ask questions. Yes. Can't get enough. People sit for an hour and a half. They're like ready to stay. You know, like
it's fascinating.
It's not. Yeah. People don't suffer through that. They are really interested.
They're gung ho. They're really interested. I am ready to get a new landscape.
They want to learn.
This guy's not good enough.
May not be interesting to you. But when we talk about the maintenance and what's going on, the place you live, I mean, for God's sakes, this is intricately tied to your being and your happiness, right? Is your home and the community. Yep. I absolutely, so you say I'm crazy, but like, for sure I would have volunteered. I would have volunteered even if it wasn't an empty board because I live there and I want a happy home and a calm home. And there's the idealism, right? That we're always talking about.
Like, so cute. Alita's so cute.
And the whole setup. It presumes that the association owners will step up and be responsible. But like this whole notion.
Conscientious voters.
Yeah, like this whole notion that you have a condominium association that's, you know, operating a multi-million
at a very high level here.
Right? We got a huge budget in some of these buildings, you know, millions of dollars.
I mean, and it's like running a business. These budgets.
It is running a business, not for profit. But
I can see that you come against the realities of whatever this budget is. I mean, like you said, sometimes there's a big budget, I guess. We've done very well. I mean, I'm assuming money's not invested or anything, but like we've done very well. We got huge coffers. If everybody wants fancy flowers, we get everybody fancy flowers. But I assume, because this is Miami, that is not the case most of the time. Fucking like huge budget.
Well,
like,
it depends on what kind of association, the market values of the units, the expectations of the membership. But it's all defined first and foremost by like the maintenance responsibilities of the association. What do they have to, and insurance costs, right?
Yes.
So management costs. Right. So yeah. So right now costs in this industry have gone up crazy, you know, in terms of the insurance crisis. But just in a general sense, the location, the type of building, the necessary maintenance, the cost of insurance, it's all going to set up a reality that'll dictate what your type of budget you're looking at, your expenses, whether you should be, you know, managed by a portfolio manager or like one of the major management companies in the industry. You know what I mean? With an on-site community association manager that runs everything.
Like a real one, not an Alina.
I mean, if you're an
site manager
in a major association, you need technically you want to hire a third party to manage it. It has to be a community association manager licensed right by the DBPR, the Department of Business and Professional Regulation. It's a highly regulated industry with you know, an administrative standard of care. You know, we work with them day in, day out representing associations. They care very much about the continuing education. Our firm, you know, is a continuing education provider for community association managers.
Where, you know,
like you have to be accredited. So like
they are,
of course,
but like it just goes to show that everybody needs to stay informed. Everybody cares. But, you know, it's an intense industry that, you know, people are really invested in.
They don't always stay informed.
Well, you'd hope they would, but unfortunately, it's not always the case.
No, it's definitely not. I learned.
So you guys on this board appoint this community association manager.
It's actually someone
you hire.
It's an independent contract.
And
associations self-manage.
Yeah.
Which means the association, it like has an employee who's a manager,
right,
who's like answering to the board directly. I'm not going to use this as an opportunity to like get on a soapbox, self-manager versus a third party manager, but
he's like, don't do that shit. No,
but I will say that, you know, depending on the type of association, you know, self-management, it may not be the best way to go in this current association environment.
Is it generally cheaper to self-manage? Is that why they turn around and do this? Because we can't pay for a professional manager that's going to deal with
it has its own host of complications, difficulties, because now the association's an employer as opposed to working with an independent contractor.
Yeah.
You can control things contractually with your independent contractor in a different way and dictate the terms of that engagement, whereas with an employee they're all yours, you know.
But that's just talking about that. I mean, I never had any idea how much work this was going to be, for the record.
No se te ocurrió. No,
but it's not just the management company. It's like the 8,000 vendors you deal with the community and all the batshit crazy psychos that live in the community. Because there's lots of normal homeowners that are like you and want the best. And then there's always the crazy fucking guy in the corner that has some crazy ass story and wants something completely off the rails and comes to every meeting to harass you about how you're taking kickbacks. And I'm like, bitch, you think I'd be living here if I was getting kickbacks? I'd be in my fucking mansion on Star Island, okay? Like, I'm not getting any sort of fucking kickback. But anyways, I digress. I digress.
I mean, it's a big
fun time.
It's a big topic. Like, there's, you know, recent homeowners association legislation because of the fear of kickbacks and need for regulation of all homeowners associations. You know, there's a lot of concern about like financial fraud in associations.
Sure.
Owners feel like they don't have power to elect their boards in some of these cases.
They could go,
you know, but it's like you have associations where nobody wants to run.
Right.
And then you have associations where people want to run, but they feel disenfranchised. They feel the process is corrupted somehow. So the legislature just enacted a bill that literally defines election fraud in HOAs. It has like literal definitions of like what constitutes election fraud, which by the way is like it's a crime, right? It's been adopted as a crime that
no mail-in ballots here.
But
no mail-in ballots.
There are no hanging chads.
You have to show up to the election, John.
There's a lot of, I mean, it's a very intense time for community associations, to put it mildly.
It seems a little stressed out. Like, he seems a little like, I'm going through a lot in my profession right now. There's a lot of activity happening. Is that what it is?
A lot. I mean, this podcast is about current events, and there is unfortunately a lot of negative stuff going on in this space, right? And you mentioned the Champlain Tower, so I think this is a good moment to talk about it.
Yeah.
So just in case someone doesn't know what that is, can you tell everyone about what happened in the Champlain Towers before we kind of delve into the law stuff?
Yeah. So several years ago, there was an unspeakable tragedy, just like you couldn't even imagine it could even occur. Where
like this many is not lives, a third world country. How
many
does this
lives
happen?
Were lost. The building essentially collapsed.
Yeah.
And I'm not here to say why or what or but just to say that it sent shockwaves, you know, obviously, you know, the tragedy is so profound, but then it had shockwaves through the whole industry, new legislation, a focus on long-term deferred maintenance of condominium high rises on the coast. And it's kind of altered how everyone thinks in terms of their own responsibilities personally.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Right. Even if, you know, the legal definition of certain standards didn't change, people are thinking to themselves, you know, what are my responsibilities? How can I protect against, you know, safety is first and foremost, the number one concern of any association. Right.
Like this shit is not coming down on my watch, at a minimum.
And this was all over national news. I mean, it did happen here in Surfside, Florida, in our local community, but it was all over national news. And the crazy part is you hear this happening all the time in other countries, like Leslie was saying.
I mean,
like,
this is not Honduras, guys. I mean, this is...
Just like a couple weeks ago, there was one that happened in Havana. There was a bunch of deaths in Havana, in Cuba. And I see it all the time in the news, but this is the United States. You know, we expect certain standards and, again, our own bias, right? But it was absolutely crazy and tragic, and not just lives lost, but God, there was so much I heard so much about the lawsuits and so much that happened afterwards too. And let's talk about it, because there are certifications you have to get, right? At the 40 year and the 50 year. Tell us about that.
The way it worked previously was in Miami-Dade County. Miami-Dade County was ahead of the state, and the municipalities at the city county level, you know, they have this recertification requirement, and it was 40 years and then 10 years thereafter, 50 years, et cetera. Right. Regarding the structural condition and electrical components of the buildings. And I'm oversimplifying. Mm-hmm. But essentially, after Champlain Tower South, the legislatures said, we're going to make this a statewide program by enacting a statute that basically put in a regime for milestone inspections. Mm. Okay, so milestone inspections are meant to kind of be similar to or kind of parallel the recertification requirements. They're inspired by the recertification requirements in South Florida. And so now statewide associations have to, you know, retain a qualified architect or engineer to perform, an engineer to perform, you know, certain testing, certain inspections first. And if the inspections show substantial structure deterioration.
This is regardless of whether you're coming up on this 40 year.
Well, I'll tell you the timing. It's for buildings that are three stories in height or more.
Uh-huh.
And basically it's 30 years, not 40.
As of 30 years, and we're starting to look at some stuff.
Yeah. And so, and it's good to get ahead of deferred maintenance like that and be doing that at 25, 30 years rather than at 40, because it becomes exponentially more damaging and not deal with this long-term deferred maintenance and restoration. And there's sometimes developer defects that don't get remediated, which is a whole nother related conversation.
Sure.
But essentially, the engineer, you know, the qualified professional does an inspection. If there's substantial structure deterioration, you go to what's phase two, where you can do destructive testing, more invasive testing. There has to be a report generated. And that report is like a hot potato. Got to go to the a summary.
I was just
going to
ask. So when this
a summary has to go to the members. Yeah, you got to go to the building department.
Does that get handed to make sure that we're all like nothing to see here? No money to do this.
There's got to be a summary to the members within a certain amount of time. A copy goes to the building officials within a certain amount of time. Oh. The association has to start work within a certain amount of time.
Yeah, of course.
This is paid for by the association, right? The members, right? And actually. You know, within 3 miles, buildings within 3 miles of the coast, the law initially said it was within 25 years. But at the time the law was enacted, some of the buildings within 3 miles of the coast were like year 26. Or
yeah, of course.
And it was like they didn't have a section to say, oh, that building is exempt for a couple of years. Like it was, you know, so it needed a glitch bill. It needed a glitch bill. And that glitch bill was enacted just a few months ago, and that's Senate Bill 154. And so the glitch bill kind of clarified some things, fixed some of these things. Now, if you're within 3 miles of the coast, it's up to the local department, you know, the municipality, like whether it'll be 25 years
or 30
years.
Like City of Sunny Isles or whatever.
Yeah. And so now you asked about recertification. Miami-Dade County, for example, which already had a recertification, they basically amended their recertification process to kind of parallel the milestone inspection process. So they kind of go hand in hand. So like Miami-Dade lowered its recertification to 30 years. It's, you know, but or 25 years within the 3 miles. But for those buildings within 3 miles, it was delayed till, you know, the end of 2024. And so right now the municipalities are still like processing Senate Bill 154 to update again.
They're still figuring shit out.
Yeah, but and actually there's like a deadline to report to the building official, you know, like statewide. So like basically, you know, there's going to be a building code review and a way to implement this at the local and state levels, you know, to like come up with standards for this whole new, you know, testing and inspection regime. And to make a long story short, you know, in Miami-Dade County, right, you have recertification. It's coming up. If a building is, you know, coming up on 30 years, and actually it's like there's timetables, right, that are coming due. And many associations are going to need their milestones done by December 1st, the 31st, 2024. Like it's coming right up.
Okay.
Some will be December 31st, 2025. Right. So, but this is like coming down the pike for many associations. They're dealing with it right now.
So like when the engineer comes up with, you know, his or her fancy report that says like this building is fucked, this rebar is gone.
That's exactly the salt water.
And that's exactly what it says. Like Brett, fucking like you are fucked. Okay.
And or you will be paying.
And this is gonna cost your fucking first child and all my sperm at the sperm bank, because that's what we just talked about. Right? Like what happens when there's no money? What happens when there isn't enough money to cover?
I was thinking the same thing. I mean,
and then how often does this happen, right? Because I immediately see like, oh shit, why would anybody not do this, right? And it's just, I think the reality of
this fall,
right?
Well, there's like a whole reality.
Yeah, I was about to say, I sat on a board. Sure, you want to make it fucking of beautiful course. And sunshine and rainbows.
That's my point.
Fucking sunshine and rainbows cost money. A lot of fucking money.
Let me basically the way it's there's a way there's like a big picture to this in a way it's kind of supposed to work. And that's a segue to like the other shoe dropping, which is the SIRS, the Structural Integrity Reserve Studies. I haven't even gotten to those.
Yeah.
That's a whole nother.
You're making engineers rich, my friend. That's all I hear right now.
But
I mean, this is excellent. All my people.
You Shaggy.
But it wasn't me.
Sorry.
I know the song.
It wasn't me.
I'm thinking of the lyrics.
That everybody at Champlain Towers said, this shit is fucked. We need a gazillion dollars to fix this whole fucking building. Yeah. And every homeowner said, I knew us.
No,
we have a shit ton of money to spend on this.
There's a term for it. And in that case, it's really tragic. But there's a term for it, which is moral hazard, right? Moral hazard, which is like in game theory and economics of like, if people don't have an incentive to do certain things, they have this incentive to do the wrong thing. So what happened was the way the law worked, and again, I'm not like here to criticize going backwards or whatever, but forever, the way it could work is that every year associations are supposed to get a reserve study.
Sure.
Not every year. They don't have to get a reserve study every year. Correct me. I'm going to correct myself. Every year the association has to budget for reserve, right? Every year the association has to budget for reserves. You get a reserve study periodically to keep it updated, but basically you budget for reserves for certain mandatory components,
okay,
right? The roof, this, that, the other. And so, or components with
the basics,
replacement, the basics,
right.
Yeah, and components with replacement costs over $10,000. And you have to think, you get a reserve study that basically says the remaining useful life, the ultimate estimated replacement costs, and you fund a little bit every year so that by the end of its life, right, it'll be all funded in your special account that can't be used for anything else.
Puppies
so you're supposed
real.
To. So you're supposed to save money for this. It's like put the money aside, but of course.
So that was statutory.
That was
guideline.
Statutory. However, statutory
people to be fiscally responsible.
But there were two issues
in Miami.
Yeah, there are two issues. There's more than two issues, but I'll boil it down. I'll boil it down to the two biggest issues, which are one, the law gave members a right to waive or reduce
to kick the can down the road.
And all it took to do this was a majority of a quorum of the members.
Oh.
So as long as you have some percentage of the members show up at the meeting, 33 and a third, a majority of those members could
the
just
16.
Say. Right. 17 owners in an association with the right side could just be like, nah,
by the way,
eventually the law said you have to put in the proxy form that waiving or reducing reserves will lead to special assessments or some other literally a statutory disclosure. You have to put in the proxy so that when people say yes. They have to see, like, oh, wait.
Right, so they don't cry 5 years from now and they owe me $100,000
So the economic reality of it is, if you use those monies for other things with the proper member vote, or if you waive or reduce with the proper member vote, you're going to, down the line, have a problematic special assessment. If it's problematic, some associations are like, yeah, no problem, you know, we'll stroke a check. But that's not always the case. It's not often the case. The other issue is this. This is different. Even though you have these mandatory reserves for certain components, mm-hmm. there was a question of, I'm a reserve study specialist. Can I even, as an industry, and again, I'm not imputing this to any particular reserve study specialist.
Allegedly.
But as an industry, Like, as part of the industry standards for doing these reserve studies, there's a question of, can I even come up with a replacement cost or useful life for the structure?
Correct.
So, like, how can I even estimate what it takes to, you don't replace the structure.
You don't so replace what would the bar, guys.
But so I what mean, could happen? In some reserve studies, you literally had structure. We can't tell you. You know, yeah. We can't tell you what it's going to cost.
Not useful.
Right. So what happens is, even if you fully reserved, you're not necessarily reserving for structural deferred maintenance or restoration at year 35, 40.
Right.
Even if you had fully reserved, it was like kind of like this.
Right. The report didn't say this building is fucked, right? Like, yeah, exactly. That's problem number two.
All buildings age.
All buildings are old and have issues and whatever. Yeah. And the report, I used to be a civil engineer for 6 years. I am fully aware that my reports are not, you know, I dealt more with drainage systems and whatever. But I don't say this drainage system is fucked. I see the contractor who got wrong. Like,
we need to do further investigation. We cannot say disclaimer. But the truth is that so there was this in some reserve studies, right? In many associations, they just didn't reserve for structural deferred maintenance. Then you have another issue, which is one of the big things our firm does is we litigate construction defect claims. When the association turns over from the developer, it's really like imperative. It's imperative to like do due diligence to get to the heart of potential structural issues beneath the surface. Because what happens is in many associations, the structural defects, they're what's called latent. They're hidden, right? So like you will never know they're there until many years later. But what happens is
they're well hidden.
But by the time they manifest, it's past what's called the statute of repose, which is like a final date to sue. So if you have the structural problem, slowly corroding rebar, whatever, eventually there's spalling, you may not even see the physical manifestation of that until many years after turnover, by which point it may be too late to sue the developer.
You're preaching
and
to the choir, my friend.
And I just want to say this, that this year, this year, the legislature lowered the statute of repose from 10 years to 7, making it even, yes, I know. I was same thing. That's
counterproductive.
I agree. It's so counterintuitive. It's crazy. But I guess
the construction lobby. Good job.
But let me say, you have this issue, which is if you catch construction defects at the beginning, you can seek recovery from construction and design professionals so the association doesn't have to eventually pay for the systemic problems that result from them. But if you lower the statute of repose, you're putting more pressure on associations to move quickly to do that immediately.
I don't know anything about construction.
And many associations, you know, some associations, they kind of want to take the easy way out. They don't want to.
Why do you want to be the one to engage in litigation against the contractor?
But to put in a different way, first of all, you have all kinds of legal expenses. You have all kinds of engineering costs to do the testing. Not to mention, if you just base that off a visual inspection and you don't have manifestation of these defects and you don't do sampling and destructive testing to get underneath the surface, you may not even know about a problem that won't materialize.
No, no.
So you have to put upfront engineering costs to this. And that's some associations don't see that point of view and they don't, they want to.
How about? Almost none.
Not the associations we represent,
all contractors are fucking ladrones.
Not me who said that.
I'm an attorney and I sat on the board. And so I think we are immediately risk averse and thinking about the potential downfalls.
Well, of course.
Convincing non-attorneys, which is, by the way, what most of the community is, that you need to spend money on studies. Okay. Like a lot of fucking money and a lot of legal fees that go along with that. And that all this is worth it to meet with some duty that's written into the law. It's just impossible. Leslie.
But seeking
like,
that
impossible. But you want to do that.
It's like, but seeking that recovery early, you have now have some source of funds you can put in the reserves. You could use to these to defray the cost of these defects. And those defects, they have residual effects.
Yeah.
Many years later, they make things worse. And these problems, if you don't do structural restoration, it just gets worse and worse. So and so by updating the timetable to 25, 30 years, you're expediting some responsible buildings. They'll deal with these things in a timely manner. They'll do timely restoration work to avoid the exponential increase of problems and the expense down the line. But if you haven't really done that, it's just that much more expensive when it's time to do it. You haven't funded the reserves fully. You maybe didn't even have a reserve account for that. And now all of a sudden, what do you have to do? You have to specially assess, which wham, you know, it slams an owner right in the face. You know, oh my God, I've got to come out of pocket
right
for this amount of money. And in some of these associations, we're talking a very large amount of money.
Buco bucks. So we were talking about buco bucks. Yeah, it's huge money. I mean, it's, and thinking about special assessments, you know, you're dealing with everyday homeowners. Most people don't.
That's when I go after Alina. Like, what do you mean I got to pay $10,000?
You want to get like mob of angry homeowners? Tell them that you're assessing them. And then I don't care where you fucking get it, but you better get $10,000, which you got to pay in the next 6 months, by the way.
You gave all our money to the lawn boy.
The building. Yeah.
That's your cousin.
They freak out, man. I'm actually dealing with it right now, not where I was the homeowner, but my parents' condo that we got them, they have a huge assessment going on right now. And, you know, my father recently passed away and that helped pay for some of the assessment at Arn. But there's a lot of elderly people in that building, retired people that live on a budget, you know, and if you live on, even if you're not elderly and retired, you live on a budget. Everyday people live on a budget. You don't have this money to spend. Like, even if you want to improve it, like, they just don't have it. They don't have it.
In some associations, the declaration actually prohibits you from passing a special assessment over a certain amount of money without a membership vote. Yeah. There's case law that I think supports potentially assessing anyway when you have necessity, because you can't allow the building to go to waste. So like, that's illegal. But frankly, I think the statute should state clearly that the declaration cannot prevent an adoption of a special assessment or require a member vote when you need to pass a special assessment to perform basic maintenance functions. We're not talking about like improvements or material
flowers.
Alterations. No. We're talking about necessary maintenance or capital maintenance, you know, like
the roof.
Yeah. But some associations feel paralyzed by those provisions. Yeah. They don't feel they can get the member votes, which is a shame, you know. Then there's also, you know, associations can borrow money. Borrowing has significant costs, but it, you know, it could potentially give cash flow so you can extend the repayment period, right? So we deal with a lot of that
either.
Now.
We try to do it. I'm telling you from experience.
They don't like that
tell
either.
Them that we're taking out a loan, we're going to pay over 10 years. They don't like that either. I mean, nobody wants to spend money.
The fact is, it has to be done. The fact is, the money has to be spent.
You have no choice. But so, okay, so we're talking about when there is no money. So let's talk for a second. I want to take us to condo terminations.
Wait. I have, hold on, before that, do association boards have to have a lawyer? Because they cannot be operating on their own, can they? Is there something in the statute that says you monkeys don't know what the fuck you're doing? You must have a lawyer represent you.
It would first of all, there's like the unlicensed practice of law, right?
Yeah, sure.
So first of all, like if you don't have a lawyer, there are certain things you just can't do without a lawyer. Yeah. Contracts, this, that, the other.
You can't like represent yourself in this.
You can't. That's that, yeah, so that's
okay.
You can't. Conversations I had about whether or not we should pay legal fees.
No,
you can't hire a third party who's not a lawyer to do legal
jaded, stuff.
Because I'm to do like the practice of law. But if you're a director, maybe you feel like, hey, I'm not going to hire a third party. I'm just going to represent. But think about it, this. Isn't just you're representing.
Correct.
You're trying to do legal stuff for an entity.
That's why.
This is where we talked about recklessness, right? If you're not working with legal counsel on legal issues, and you're then what right do you have to rely on it? What can you base reasonableness off of? So it probably would be inherently unreasonable to be a on a board without legal counsel to confer with as to certain, you know, legal issues that need legal counsel. I mean, I guess if a director's a lawyer, but even then there's all kinds of issues.
Yeah. Okay, I'm a lawyer, my friend. I don't know none of this shit.
Let me cut through like the legal, you know, association should have a lawyer.
Yes. Gente en Hialeah, presta atención. You need a lawyer.
In Hialeah, do you know how many conversations I had where they're like, you're a lawyer? I'm like, I'm not that kind of lawyer.
Associations.
Oh, shit, about condo law.
I'm an immigration
lawyer. No, I cannot be our
associations need a lawyer.
Legal fee to a condo
and you know,
lawyer.
And you know what? This is a big public service announcement. I'm full of cliches. A stitch in time saves nine, right? Like this. So, but like, but basically, if you think you're saving money by like not working with a lawyer,
right,
and not negotiating that contract with a lawyer, or like, hey, I don't want to ask the lawyer, But then what happens is it costs much more to clean up the mess.
In Spanish, we say lo barato sale caro, which means cheap shit is very expensive.
Yes. Right?
That's what that means.
Exactly.
Cheap shit is very expensive. So no, so I want to go back to this when we have no money, right? Let's talk about condo terminations. You and I were briefly discussing it before we came on, and I think this is fascinating. So tell everybody who's listening, what's a condo termination?
Sure. So a condo termination is a process. What happens in a condominium, so basically property has units and common elements owned by all the unit owners.
Right.
And it's literally submitted to condominium ownership through its condo declaration. So now you have this property set up where owners own the units, they own the common elements and pertinent shares that are attached to their units. A termination ends that. It basically frees the whole property from the declaration, from the ownership structure. Everybody just owns it all, but this is usually done in the context of either restarting a new condominium from scratch or redeveloping the land.
You're knocking this shit down.
Yeah, so you knock it down and replace it with a new building, with a new condominium declaration. Because absent a termination to get rid of that condominium form, you can't just transfer you could, there's ways, it's complicated, but a termination is a simple way to end that condo declaration, free up the entire property so that it can be redeveloped into something new with a new condominium form of ownership or other form of ownership, declaration, what have you. And a termination, it like fundamentally changes what everybody's owning, because like you own a unit that's yours, but a termination can literally end your ownership of that unit. It's
right.
A forced buyout in many ways.
Yeah.
Okay. So it's like a forced buyout. And so, it's a very technical process. I'm not going to go into all the technicalities. Suffice it to say that there's a couple of instances where terminations come into play. First, there can be what's called like an optional termination, right? Where, for redevelopment, for whatever purposes, you get a sufficient number of votes to optionally terminate. Okay, when would that occur? When you have a redeveloper buying up units, they get to a critical mass, they try to terminate. You have catastrophe termination, right? Where you have a hurricane, it pretty much destroys. So there's like a different voting threshold for like a catastrophe termination where you need to reconstruct and it would be wasteful to do so.
Yeah, but for example,
And then the other one is like you could go to court and get a termination.
Oh, interesting.
It's like a statutory,
like a partition, like?
Yeah, it's like a statutory proceeding to terminate. It was actually done with Champlain Tower South when a building collapsed, rather than go through these votes and all these corporate. You know, they just basically said we need to file an action to terminate this condo because it's destroyed, this and that.
Yeah.
So I have an interesting story about this. And when I was young, when I was a kid, my parents had a condo in Miami Beach. It was our weekend property and whatever. We used to fish every weekend and go out to the beach every weekend. And at some point, there were a lot of repairs that had to be made. There was going to be a giant assessment, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Couldn't afford it. Not my parents, just in general, the community, it wasn't happening. It was mostly retired people community. It was only a two-story building. So it was a little place, had a great piece of land, but little place. And so a developer came in and offered to buy everybody out because we couldn't make the repair.
Big Daddy Trump said, I'm going to put a massive high rise here.
Exactly,
get the
right.
Fuck out.
It's where the Trump Towers were. That's exactly where it was at. But anyways, that being said, I remember it being a complete fucking nightmare because some people wanted in, some people didn't. God, I remember those condo association meetings. I was a kid and I remember these condo association meetings.
He was roped in from a childhood.
The yelling and
your, the trauma.
The trauma.
Maybe that's what led to her becoming a lawyer to help other people.
Because it required 100%. So like everyone.
So there's one old lady holdout.
Correct.
That's like, I'm not leaving.
Everyone had to be on board, and getting every condo owner to agree to this was nearly impossible. So this was meeting upon meeting.
It's so funny because when I was in property law in law school, it was like they were talking about all this and it was so theoretical. And I'm like, I'll never deal with this in my practice. And so now, of course, it's like holdouts and transaction costs and like, but that's what this, it's all about holdouts and how difficult it is to get everybody together. And
it
used to be, right, and it used to be that many declarations, some declarations 75%, some declarations 100%. But what happens is the statute has evolved. right? There was an amendment to the termination statute that really overhauled procedures, but also the voting requirements to like optionally terminate. And that has evolved over the years. First, it was you could terminate voluntarily with 80% of the membership.
There you go.
But 10%.
2007.
Yeah.
I looked it up.
Wow. Yeah.
And this was after our nightmare with 100%.
Yeah. So then 10% could block. That how do you block? You give objections in a timely manner. But then,
oh, you're going to rally your neighbors.
But then it's such a controversial concept. Yeah. There was an outcry like, oh, we can't.
Like, this is a taking.
People have homestead rights. Yeah.
Constitutional. So what did they do?
They lowered the block to it's 5%. So 5% could block. So it's like a smaller percentage of owners could block, not 10%, but 5%. So it's even harder to terminate. And so you have this 80% in favor, 5% can block.
Are these in the condo docs?
More and more.
Or are these in the
statute? It's in the statute. This is statutory.
So you know these laws before you.
This is a huge issue. Like literally there's litigation left and right over this because the statute, right? It's changed. But docs, what law governs the docs? What law governs that condo? So like some condominiums say, this condominium is submitted to the condominium form of ownership pursuant to the Condominium Act as it may be renumbered. So like that's interpreted to mean in like 1980, you know, like whenever that declaration was recorded, right? Like it's submitted to the Condominium Act that exists at that time. Only when the declaration has something called Kaufman language, which is like as amended from time to time.
Yeah.
Does like the statutory changes automatically apply? And there's been like tons of litigation on this.
Oh my God.
Like if it says Condominium Act as amended from time to time, the new law applies. If it says Condominium Act, the old law applies. So what do redevelopers do? They amend the declaration to add Kaufman language. And so now there's all kinds of litigation over, can you just like amend the declaration right. Add Kaufman language? It took 100.
What percentage of these people are showing up to meeting?
Yeah, but with what percentage can you amend?
I don't even know what they're
does
talking about.
Does a normal amendment, right? And maybe some declarations have special provisions that says if you alter the statute that applies or voting rights of to terminate, that requires 100% vote. But if it doesn't say that, can you just amend with like 66 2/3 to add Kaufman language? Now, all of a sudden, you have this other. So this is a very
like hostile takeover shit.
This
right?
is like technical.
Condo style.
It's like, technical. It's a very dynamic area of law with new cases. And
need a lawyer. Like. Oh, yeah. He's a lawyer for this.
Yeah. Jose Papito was a lawyer in Cuba, bro.
But there's,
it's fine. It's
there's
fine.
Definitely strength in numbers where if owners, you know, use their power to work
this is
together,
horrifying.
It's a lot of, you know, game theory, you know? It's like,
theory.
It's like, hey, you know, we got a big enough block, you know? Well, but it's being litigated right now. Associations have to be eyes open in dealing with that reality.
Yeah.
Some documents can have provisions that are very good protections against this, and other documents can be very favorable to this, and it's a fluid thing and it can change. So like some associations are like, maybe that's a concept that we welcome because, you know, we'll talk about the structural integrity reserves are going to go up and all these capital improvements need to be done, and we don't want to pay for that. We think it's waste based upon the value of the units. We want to sell out.
Getting more expensive.
Yeah, but other associations are like, hell no, we don't want to be bought out. We got to protect ourselves from this, or we want to have leverage. Some associations are interested but want to leverage the process by doing it a certain way so that the association is dictating the terms of engagement, not somebody like kind of scooping up units. Sir, you know, behind the scenes, right?
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, yeah.
So if someone is in the market to buy in a property that has an HOA, that has this condo, whatever.
Oh, I'll have that condominium.
So they should really get a copy of this, I'm sure, very large document with all of the rules.
It's actually required to be the
And should they immediately
the
call someone like you to review such things?
Oh, yeah.
Do you have like a package? Like, hey, I'll review all the shit show you're about to enter into.
We
for $5,000.
It's a very dynamic area. Like, we look at this from the perspective of the association who may be dealing with this, who is interested in thinking about
it. No, screw them. From the homeowner.
We look at this from the acquirer's perspective, right? We represent acquirers who are like, what are going to be the steps we need to take? you know, in order and to acquire units here, what are the covenants?
Tell you what your reserves are.
What are,
I guess,
the covenants,
right?
that apply
in the different buckets?
There's different issues. There's like purchase and sale restrictions. Sure. Some condominium declarations say there's a right of first refusal for the association. Some say there's a right of first refusal that another owner can exercise as like the designee of the association. So now the association can allot, you know, can use that right of first refusal to push units a certain way. There's also, you know, restrictions on transfers where some association declarations say you cannot own more than X number of units through any affiliate.
Wow.
Some say no corporation
can own
units.
Here.
Right. So like you have to think about what's the landscape of these governing documents, what restrictions apply, how can we deal with that reality? You know, so we're always thinking about those legal angles.
But yeah, when you're buying a property, part of it, if there is an HOA, generally involves them vetting you and doing a whole application for them.
I mean, it sounds like the fucking homeowner should be vetting them.
Well, it
was just, no, that's a really good point. That's a funny point, though, because
I mean, my point
that's
is
like
you
a
need
really,
to have a package
but
for
that's,
owners
but,
to call you.
But
he takes Venmo,
this
Zelle,
is like
credit
a big
card.
Issue right now. This is actually what you're talking about is a big issue right now. Like,
yeah.
It's never been more important in terms of the requirements and disclosures relating to sales and what you have to disclose to third parties,
yes.
and what you don't have to disclose, and like how do you deal with these requests? And like the Miami-Dade has a registry that, you know, as of this February, it started where condominiums had to report information about themselves and upload certain reports. So now theoretically there could be, you know, there's like a registry, a database. You also have, you know, you also have laws that require certain documents now. The milestone, you know, has to be like, you know, there's rescission rights for contracts if the documents aren't available.
I very much remember when we purchased asking the realtor on the other side of the deal, are the reserves healthy?
That's exactly where I was going
with
this, right?
The due diligence.
I want to buy something.
The due diligence for a condominium association is so complex and important and difficult.
But here's the thing.
It's,
no, the realtor's going to
be
tell
like,
you
yes,
whatever the
check,
fuck.
Go
right.
ahead.
I was exactly going to say this.
Nobody.
The realtor's going to tell you whatever the fuck you need to know to buy the property, right?
They can't lie to me, or then we have.
But what the fuck do they know? I mean, I assume the only person that can assess whether this bucket of money that has been reserved or whatever actually means anything compared to that building, right? I mean, how would I as a third party know that maybe I see a reserve of $500,000, I think that's fucking great, and you immediately go,
like,
oh, this is trash.
As a lawyer who represents associations and is that. Familiar with the industry, I'd have a sense there's different dynamics in play. It's complex, but like, for example, I might know that like at certain years you're more likely to have this type of project. If it wasn't done, this next project is going to be worse. Did defects get dealt with? Have they been reserving? Have they not been reserving? Oh, it's been this many years. Recertification's coming up.
This is a whole stream of income you are not marketing to, Jonathan. Potential new homeowners need
due diligence.
Assessment on this shit show they're about to buy too.
When you're buying, you need to. One of the most important questions is, when was this built? 100%.
Yeah, like, of course. Yeah.
That was the first thing we'd ask, because I want to know if you're coming up on 20, 30. Like, these are big milestones. You want to keep, if your building was built in the last 15 years or so, pretty solid.
But this goes back for now. This goes back to what we were talking about in terms of milestone. And then the other thing, structural integrity reserve study. So, like, these are things that are going to be required. They have to be available for buyers.
That's
so buyers can see the structural integrity reserve study, which is like, it's like a reserve study, but geared towards the structural components. And it takes that issue of structural components. How do you reserve them?
Yeah.
And it kind of answers that in the sense that it does answer that in the sense that certain components you must reserve for, you must get a study for if you have a building that's over three stories or more in height and you're a condominium, and that commercial condominiums accepted. But basically you now have to get a certain kind of study with a certain kind of professional who can tell you what the remaining useful life is or the deferred maintenance. So even if you don't replace it, what's the deferred maintenance expense to do major capital maintenance over many years, like restoration? And actually in Senate Bill 154, you know, people were panicking of like in 2025, right? You're going to have your structural reserve study done by the end of 2024. Then you start to to fund the structural integrity reserves. And by the way, let's say you have a structural integrity deferred maintenance expense of X million, and it's the useful life before you should do that maintenance is 2 years. and you didn't ever reserve for that.
Yeah, you
should. Now all of a sudden, the law requires that the next, you know, starting 2025, and this was changed a little bit in Senate Bill 154, but originally 4D 2 years ago, last year, it basically said you have to fund this. And you have to fund the useful life through that year. You didn't have to fund the total replacement cost, but you had to be on schedule to be fully funded, which means if you had never reserved before for that, all of a sudden it hits you, wham,
right.
You have only 2 years left. You now got to fund everything up to 2 years left immediately. And that would be in the reserves, in the budget, not even a special assessment, in the budget. And that couldn't be waived or reduced. And so Senate Bill 154 this year, it tries to alleviate this a little bit and tinker with it in subtle ways. But like, let me just put it this way. It's still that's still the way it is. If you don't have to do the milestone till 2025, you can get an extra year, you know, to do the reserve study. Also, if the expert says, oh, I can't tell you the remaining useful life. It's too long. It's too far out. I can't tell you deferred maintenance. I don't recommend deferred maintenance. It's too far out. Then you don't have to do it. You don't have to add it. You don't have to add a reserve if the expert says, last year, 4D never had that out. But now it's a little bit of a loophole where, like, if the study basically says, oh, we don't know how long it's going to last. We can't give you deferred maintenance. We don't recommend deferred maintenance. Now, it would, you know, the professional who's providing.
Like, make sure that asshole has a lot of insurance.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. The professional providing. The professional providing that reserve study has to be able to stand behind that. It's got to be a reasonable.
Yeah.
Right. And so like if you have deferred maintenance that needs to be done and it's recommended and you know, the reserve study can't say, oh, no deferred maintenance is recommended. But like it gives a little bit more of a safety valve if it's really far out. But once it becomes something that's got to be recommended, you start accumulating it. So but it's still a very heavy financial burden up front, like in the short term. So like this is like a segue for both disclosures with transfers, where like you're buying a unit, you want to know what that structural integrity reserve study says.
Oh, I definitely want to know all of this.
And then the other thing is you want to know what's in the budget for the structural integrity reserve.
Absolutely.
And then for purposes of, you know, this kind of financial stress makes a condominium unit owner and the board say, hey, you know, maybe it's time to, you know, call it quits on this whole condominium thing.
what does that mean? Call it quits on the condominium? We're selling to Big Daddy Trump? Like, what does that mean?
So we were kind of talking about all of this is in place to protect technically the homeowners. And so I want to talk a little bit more about that. So what is in place to help homeowners when there's actual shit going down on the board? So let's talk about the hammocks. Let's talk about
the what?
That's where I want to talk about the hammocks. So there's this area in here in South Florida called the hammocks, and they were all over the news recently. Leslie lives in a bubble.
Where's the hammocks?
No idea. You're gonna have to tell me.
That's
hammocks. Out west, there was a big homeowner association community. You know, here's my lawyer. You know, like I'm not. You know, this is all from public. You know, whatever. I say nothing.
Allegedly,
I say nothing. You know, okay. Alita, you can describe it.
Okay, at the hammocks, what happened?
It's not really a laughing matter. People were arrested.
Oh,
it was like
arrest.
There were arrests. Allegations of a highly complicated criminal conspiracy. You know, fraud.
But I mean, what kind of criminal conspiracy? You know, like my cousin is
again.
A
I'm not accused. I'm just relaying what's in the news.
No, it's all alleged. But what type of fraud are we talking about? My cousin's a landscaper and he gives me a kickback. Like, what are we talking about? I just stole the fucking money from the budget thing.
Well, let's just
from the reserve.
Allegedly.
Let's just speak in the abstract about what theoretically could happen.
Theoretically, in a place in Hialeah.
Yeah, in law school they call it bad acre. Okay.
Bad acre.
Black acre, bad acre.
In law school, they call it bad acre, you know, where the bad actors
the bad
on the
actors
board.
Live.
And there's all kinds of, like, theoretical things that could be done in Bad Acre that are very bad. Like,
and they had a lot of money in Bad
Acre? This is not, like, a lesson on how to, you know, but it's a lesson of vigilance. Like,
did they
have
a lawyer?
Bad Acre?
Yeah. In Hialeah.
Bad Acre might have a lawyer.
Might have bad lawyer?
But you know what? Bad Acre may only give the lawyer certain information.
That's true.
Bad the lawyer, maybe Bad Acre wants to save money on legal fees. You know,
Save the legal fees.
You know, Bad Acre may work with vendors who are straw men for the people on the
fake P&Ls.
Yeah, got so it. Like you,
Bad
you
know, Acre has a lot of
there's
stuff.
Like entities that are created.
This is sophisticated Bad Acre.
Fraudulent transact like. This is financial chicanery.
You're right.
It's a sunny place for shady people.
It is. It is. Every episode, we have to be reminded.
You know, so, I mean, look, it, in a very simple sense, you know, directors can't receive improper personal benefits. Yes, yes. They can't, you know, take money from the association, kickbacks, that kind of thing. The, you know, again, like I said, the HOA law, you know, clarifies some of these things even more now, but it's still, it's always been a breach of fiduciary duty to do that. Arguably already criminal. There's more refined specific crimes about it now. But yeah, but so there can be very complicated, sophisticated schemes to defraud an association. But, and it's a horror.
Like,
but
how long were these people on the board? Like this one that was there for 4 years, which sounds really sketchy. I don't know.
But let me say,
because somebody's going to come right after you, right?
Part of the dynamic is that there's an issue of who's like, who's on this?
Who's on
first? Is this like something that law enforcement's going to jump on? And what kind of due diligence and investigation will warrant further investigation by law enforcement? The Division of Condominiums, which fields complaints for condominiums, they previously weren't even dealing with HOAs.
No. I'm thinking the next HOA people look at whatever, you know, financial reporting metrics you give to the next and go, what the fuck is
that's why
Selena?
Associations need to have financial reporting. They need to have financial statements.
Yeah, you also pay out of the wazoo.
Yeah, and a new, you know, a new board should
keeper.
Yeah, if there's a red flag, a new board can investigate the old board, you know, and the old, you know, the old things that were going on to try to capture back some of that. Go after fidelity bonds that households have to keep.
So this became like an ongoing, like, I don't want to sue my neighbor. They might have
But let me just put this out there that, like, who's enforced? Like, for unit owners, owners often get desperate and act improperly.
Yeah.
Because they don't have an outlet that's constructive or know any better to do things the right way.
Yeah.
You have certain inspection rights to look at records. You could get all the records of an association. You can have a CPA for a performing forensic audit of all the association records on your
from
dime.
From Arthur Anderson.
But that's the thing, on your dime. But like, it's not just the association has the CPA do this, but an owner, right, who's skeptical, what do? They could have another CPA look at the CPA audit, say, help me, let me understand. They could have the CPA do a forensic audit of the books and records. What's going on? But what's the smoke that leads them to investigate whether there's fire?
Oh, I would assume
what's that signal?
Broke.
Not to mention, what owner incentive is there to spend money out of their pocket for the benefit of everybody? Because owners have this fractional interest. And one owner is going to have to foot this bill.
No, for sure.
For the entire community. You know what I mean? It's like a selfless thing to say, I'm going to be the one who sheriffs this place.
Yeah.
Who, like, is going to get this investigation done. Who's going to go to the authorities.
It only takes one, though, Jonathan.
Hey, you know?
Wait,
But associations
can investigate.
Yeah, but again, until you take over the board, and that's why there was so much frustration. For example, at the Hammocks, there was frustration of, can we get elected?
Get elected.
There was allegations of like a canceled election meeting, like at the last second. It's like really sort of.
Oh my God, this is like South America all over again. Like the ballots aren't even real. Like,
you know, I like to say that it's good for owners to try to work together to like,
of course,
you know, keep, but to investigate. What I mean by that is owners should get, if an owner has suspicions or problems, they should pool together to try to do these inspections, to try to collaborate, to pool resources, to take these investigations further, maybe get help from legal counsel. But then, you know, there's an offshoot to this, which is really unfortunate, which is like the opposite of this. It's like a mirror funhouse image of this, which is when a group of owners like goes negative, that it curdles. It like
a witch hunt.
It curdles. Like it's the opposite of this. Like on the one hand, you have situations where owners like are rightfully frustrated and don't have an avenue or relief, and they should get together and investigate and keep the association in compliance, however you can, with whatever legal tools that aren't ideal for that. But in the flip side, owners who feel stymied, who don't feel like they have that outlet, they go negative.
they harass sometimes. Not all. Not all. Many owners are good, but some owners start to harass, become toxic. Insult. They do things that are war. It's not just mere dissension or disagreement, which is fine. Everybody, you know, of course, free speech, but like it goes beyond that into like harassment, stalking sometimes, you know, violence, making people miserable, violating, you know, using these records tools to abuse, like, you know, and making unfounded accusations. And like, so it can,
crazy.
So it kind of goes both ways. Like sometimes the owner effort is in good faith and it's like meant to be constructive, even if maybe it's right, maybe it's wrong. But other times owner effort's in bad faith and very destructive.
Oh, yeah.
And we deal with that too. That's like something that's part of the association reality. And actually the bad actors in general kind of poison the industry, in that when you have enough negative, bad faith actors, when a good, positive group of owners trying to bring good light, they're scrutinized as if they could become
crazy.
bad actors.
They're crazy.
Not always. Not, you know.
Right.
But like.
Like Alina having sat on a board already would be like. Yes, it's not.
There's
like,
a danger of
already skewed to that.
Yeah, there's a danger that like people are like desensitized or like think, oh, just another group of bad actors. But no, it may be they have a reasonable gripe. Who knows?
I mean, I hear that as someone who sat on a board for a couple of years. I hear that. But man, people are batshit crazy too, I'll tell you. Like, I just, some of the things that are said, some of the, just there are boundaries that you shouldn't cross. and homeowners can be cray cray. I'm just saying. Some of it comes from a good place of wanting to better the community. And some of it is just fucking crazy. Like, you start asking people for $5 more than what they're they think they're supposed to be paying. And it becomes a witch hunt of, you are stealing our money. No, have you looked at the cost of roofing? Because it has gone up, my friends, in the last couple of years. And nobody wants to be told they need to pay more money. No one wants to be told they need to spend more in legal fees. Man, you want to get a group of homeowners angry? Tell them we need to spend more in legal fees. I learned the fucking hard way, okay? That me telling them that I cannot be our legal representative
after you've already been thrown on this board. I love it
right now. But anyways, we're not gonna. I digress. I digress.
But we see all kinds of things, you know.
What's
and
the craziest thing you've ever seen?
You
gotta have some good stories.
I've seen a lot of different. I've seen a lot of different kinds of things. So like, it's tough to pinpoint one thing. One of the craziest things that's ever happened in my career is a cyber stalking injunction. Oof. Where, you know, we had to literally, a director and a manager were being like tormented by email.
Yeah.
Just tormented with threats, not just like insults, but like insults and threats. Like, oh, you know, I'm going to do this. And so,
scary.
And so,
and
working,
you all live next door to each other.
And
so
working,
crazy.
I'm telling you, it could be scary.
Yeah. Working together with the management team. And the director, like, they filed, and we, for the association, sought an injunction pursuant for cyber stalking because they were using email in this way, harassing, a threat.
Yeah.
And this owner came to this hearing, and like, I remember he had some injury on his foot and put it on the table in front of the judge, said he was meeting with President Obama, like a little bit, you know.
Not well in the head.
You know, it was a crazy hearing. It was.
Obama didn't come. But
we got a cyber stalking injunction.
Hillary's emails.
The injunction can prevent them from being in the management office except for certain office hours or times, or make them stay 40 feet away. No weapons.
Not come knock on my
right?
door.
No weapons. That's important if you have an order.
Weapons. Oh,
you
my know,
like,
God.
No, you can't come within 50 feet of this director who you've been harassing. You can't communicate by email to individuals. You can only use this specific designated email address. Right. You'd be surprised.
Email
like,
the
and, it, and actually
don't spam me on my personal email.
Yeah, and actually it did normalize, like it settled the situation down. So that was one of the craziest things I've dealt with, where you see actual threats, and that's not an isolated incident. I've seen that since. Like, it's something we deal with periodically, and it's very frightening. Imagine you're a voluntary director and you're receiving threats. It's horrifying. So like, there's different alternatives to that. It's not just stalking. There's other things you could do. Seek, you know, injunctive relief to combat a nuisance, bring a lawsuit, or, you know, there's other relief. You could talk to law enforcement if there's threats, right? And law enforcement might get a protective order to prevent them from having a weapon. You know, like, there's all kinds of things you deal with that. But those are some of the craziest things. And of course, you know, you see crazy things with like infestations. Like some of the craziest things I've seen are photos of like hoarders and like, you know, bugs and like that kind of horrific. You'd be amazed. Like,
Person with the unit next to mine is like a hoarder and whatever, and is causing me
1,000 cockroaches next door. They're coming into your unit. Like,
I don't even want to
clean you up.
I don't know. I don't know. I can't say no more. I just
I am bound by attorney-client privilege.
All I know is crazy things happen.
The cockroaches survive.
Crazy things happen in community associations.
They do. They do.
Listen, I can say no more. But
dinosaurs died. The roaches survived.
You see these really extreme nuisance cases with like,
of course,
you know, hoarding and all that kind of things. That's like a condo cliche.
Have you ever seen that show? Have you seen the Hoarders?
I have not.
Oh man,
it's probably one of the most unnerving things.
The TV show is out of control, and just the bugs, the bed bugs, and the roaches, and what are you gonna do? What can you do? Right, you're trapped.
Well,
in
one
situation.
One of the things associations
with neighbor that has this situation.
Well, one of the things I mean, just speaking generally in a general sense, one of the foundational things in condo law is that condominium associations have a right of access in condominiums. So, like, if you're in a condominium association and you have a unit that is like causing a menace to other units, and it needs an immediate repair or maintenance or something like urgently, the governing documents and the statute are going to say that the association has a right to access that unit to do what's necessary. And you know, from my perspective, it's like, fix it first and ask who's paying for it second. You know, like, not that you should lose sight of that, but sometimes people are, oh, they've got to pay for it, or I'm not doing it, or, but that's not a construct. Like,
no.
It should just be done. It should be fixed, abate the nuisance, and then if you need to go after the owner who caused it, you do so.
Yeah.
Good advice.
Good advice. I was about to say closing words. It's been fun, but our time's up. So
we have so much more to talk about.
I know.
This is like therapy, so I don't want it to end.
I'm so glad we've been good for your mental health, Jonathan. So any closing thoughts for our listening and viewing audience?
I have a closing thought. I feel like you need a landing page where people could just pay you $5,000 to like review condo shit before they buy it.
Leslie's trying
to know, like 100%. I could see a huge market for anyone that wants to buy into something like this. They have no your realtor is, no offense to your realtor.
The problem with
not
the
fucking clown to ask.
This will probably be a cottage industry that arises.
Yeah.
And the problem with it is, the cost, the level of care that is involved, the level of duty you're assuming, can you be compensated enough for that?
Yeah.
And what are the risks? And how can you really diagnose these issues? So you have to be very careful to disclaim, you can't like promise, you can't like, what is the value of that? And what is the due diligence required, and what is the
out in your retainer. We'll talk.
It's like a hard,
We'll figure that out.
We
Jonathan.
Have a great contract attorney.
Don't you worry.
You too.
Don't you worry. We're gonna limit your liability, but believe me, you have a lot of value to provide to potential homeowners.
It's definitely an industry that is gonna be a growing one.
Yeah. Yes, for sure.
Okay, so thank you for your closing thought, Jonathan. Do you have closing thoughts?
Because I always got thoughts, Jonathan.
Yeah, I mean, I guess my number one closing thought would be that the stakes have really never been higher for associations because of these financial burdens, because of the duties, because of these tragedies that have occurred and these crazy controversies. And so it's just more important than ever to, you know, if you're a director, to do what you have to do with care and like consult with your professional team, legal counsel. You know, even if it costs a little extra to have that extra due diligence, it's worth it in the long run, and it'll save money. And just anyone dealing in this association environment, just understand that it's more intense than ever. So there's like a lot of intensity from buyers who need information, from owners who are afraid, directors who are dealing with crazy challenges. So like in that intense environment, it's important to remain civil, professional, and, you know, and just to have perspective. So I guess that's my final
perspective.
And empathy.
Perspective and empathy.
Seriously, because everybody's dealing with a lot of challenges right now.
I'm laughing at you. It's terrible.
That is very nice.
That's nice.
The wholesome final thought.
Remember, hey, you know, I'm a wholesome guy.
You are.
Did you ever watch Jerry Springer?
Yeah, I remember Jerry.
So Jerry Springer used to have a whole hour where people would beat the crap out of each other. And then he'd end it with the same, like a closing thought. And his last line always was, take care of yourself and each other.
Oh, that's right. How fucking nice.
There you go.
Like people beating the shit out of each other for an hour on his show.
Perspective anyways, and empathy.
That's funny.
But I like it. I love it. Thank you so much, Jonathan, for coming today and for joining us. This has been Law Shit You Should Know. Join us next time for some more
Law Shit.
Thank you guys so much for having me. Thank you. Really appreciate it.
Take care.